Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken. With our final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers. We are soldiers.
Hello, folks, and thank you for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk. Excuse me. Part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And you can find the... Excuse me, I had a sip of coffee there, and it went down the wrong pipe. And you can find the Patriot Journalist Network at www.patriotjournalist.com. Please check it out. And if you do, send a message to Mark Presick and tell him I said hello. Tonight, we will have with us Mr. Judge Gray, the Libertarian Vice Presidential nominee in 2012. And we will get his thoughts on the current issues and other topics of liberty, and a little bit about Mr. Gray. And from 1972 through 1975, Gray practiced law with the Judge Advocate General's Court of the U.S. Navy in Guam and California. And after 5 years in private practice, he was named to the Santa Ana Municipal Court in 1983 by Governor George Duke Majan, who then appointed Gray to the Orange County Superior Court in 1989. In 2004, Gray defeated former Libertarian Party of California Chair Gail Lightfoot in a statewide primary for the party's nomination for the U.S. Senate. Gray suspended his judicial activities while running for the Senate against incumbent Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer, in which he received over 216,000 votes. He is also the author of Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It, a judicial indictment on the war on drugs in 2001, and is featured in the 2007 documentary American Drug War, The Last White Hope. Judge Gray is also a jurist on the law. And remember, folks, that Bard's Logic Political Talk is the grassroots We the People show. And so thank you very much for coming to the show tonight. If you like the show, please consider following it by going to its homepage here on Blog Talk Radio, by simply going to the follow button underneath the show's icon and click it, and you will also get email updates on when the show is airing and the topic. And also, if you could share the links here from Blog Talk Radio, and of course you can download the archive of this episode and share with folks where they can listen to it on their iPhones or smartphones. You can even download it to a CD in which people at their leisure can listen to and in their cars or what have you. And also look forward in the next coming weeks for Bard's Logic Political Talk to have a page on Facebook, and also visit the website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. Now, tonight, right now, I have on one of the producers here of the show, and also a good friend and author of The Hidden Fourth Branch, who will tell us a little bit more about Mr. Gray, and that is Kelly Mordecai. And, of course, get his book and with the website of the same name at thehiddenfourthbranch.com. Welcome to the show, Kelly. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. I'm rather excited. Judge Gray is just, he's a really neat guy. I love that he's a jurist. You know, I got a scholarship last year to the Libertarian National Convention where I watched Gary Johnson become, you know, the nominee. But I was just kind of, you know, looking at this You know, someone like my book scholarship sent me to Vegas. These people love the Constitution. They really do. I went to the state convention a little over a month ago, and I am just excited to hear Judge Gray's input, because obviously as a jurist, he is well-known, well-studied in the law, and a legal philosopher, if you will. And obviously he likes the Constitution, and I'm just really excited to hear his thoughts and some current events, other constitutional issues, where we were, where we're headed. So with that, I just want to bring on Judge Gray.
Okay, and we do have him on the line, so at this time I will open up his mic. Thank you very much, Judge Gray, for coming to the show. How are you?
Well, I'm just great, thank you. Life is good, and it's just nice to be with good people.
No, I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. Kelly, you've got some things together for Mr. Gray, and so I appreciate it. If you'd like to start things off, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I'm just curious. You were born in the 40s, went to law school, et cetera, USC. You became a judge, which presiding judge, if I understand that right. That's the top judge in Orange County, or any county for that matter. But tell a little bit more about yourself and what transitioned you to bring you where you eventually became a VP candidate.
Well, I think I was blessed to be born to two really good and supporting parents. I was raised to believe that one of the greatest things you can do in life is be of service to others. After I graduated from UCLA undergraduate, I was in the Peace Corps in Costa Rica for a couple of years, in the smallest town in Costa Rica that had a high school. And I probably held the record, and still do, for brushing my teeth in front of more elementary school classes than anybody in history. And I was involved with recreation, athletics, that sort of thing. And then went to law school, and then in the it was a Navy JAG attorney doing criminal defense work and other things. And then a federal prosecutor in Los Angeles for several years, prosecuted pretty much everything, including drug offenses and bank robberies and the rest. Private practice, and then a judge. But I'm probably as much of a generalist, Kelly, as anybody I know, that I've traveled a lot. I've written a musical. I love music. I'm involved with athletics, still at my age, playing basketball and tennis. And I just think that what you want to do is get an education which trains you to think. If you want to learn facts, you can read most any book. But to get an education and train you to analyze issues and try to do something in life which is complicated, but put together programs that work. And you were mentioning the Constitution. I'm agog at the Constitution. It's clearly, in my opinion, the most incredible document ever written by the hand of mankind. And it's really, I don't say this very often, but it might as well be divinely inspired. It just is a sensational document that we've gotten away from. And I think that we would all do well to look at it. I've actually, as a judge, I was a judge for 25 years, had occasion to swear people into various offices, bar associations, whatever. So you have them swear to uphold and defend the Constitution. Then I literally have them keep their hands up and say, but before you even do that, swear that you'll read it. And I think numbers of my colleagues as fellow judges, really in reading their opinions, have not read the Constitution. And if you agree with it, of course, you should follow it. Or even if you don't agree, when you don't agree with it, you should cause it to be changed. But otherwise, it is the supreme law of the land, and we must follow this wonderful institution that ensures and enshrines our civil liberties, because our liberties, the things that are the soul of the United States of America, the soul that makes us great, that makes people want to come here, be Americans, is under attack by our very own government, and that is our liberties and our freedoms. And they're protected by the Constitution, but they're under attack today by our very own government. And I'm appalled and really disturbed about what I'm seeing.
Oh, absolutely. I turn on the news, and I sometimes shouldn't do it because I just get frustrated. What do you think about some of the current, like Miss Lerner, who she took the fifth, whatever. this morning regarding the IRS congressional hearings. I mean, we're kind of out of control, but just some of your thoughts on current events, you know, Benghazi, et cetera, et cetera.
Well,
AP getting raided by the, was it DHS or the FBI?
Kelly, we're human, and that's why it's so essential to be a government of laws, not of men or women. We need to have an institutional. We have checks and balances among our various organizations, and included in the checks and balances now really are the media, folks like you included, to get the word out for free expression, free thought, a free exchange of ideas. But yes, it's. I don't hold a president of the United States accountable for trying to put in things like the so-called Patriot Act or even the National Defense Authorization Act, these direct attacks on our civil liberties. But you have to understand that the pressure on a sitting president to keep us free, keep us safe, is crushing. But I do hold the courts responsible, and I do hold the Congress responsible for these intrusions into our civil liberties. And all you need to do is to look at the Constitution to see that the function of government is to protect the individual, to protect the individual's freedoms, and not to increase the size, the power, the intrusion of government. It really should be the other way around. And you can look back at Thomas Jefferson, certainly one of my heroes of history, and he would say that a people afraid of the government is tyranny. A government afraid of a people is democracy. Guess where we are today? And this so-called war on terror, the government intentionally, from my standpoint, is trying to keep us in fear, playing up all of these possible attacks, etc., taking away our civil liberties in the process. It does not make us safer, but it does take away what makes us great. And again, that is our freedoms and our liberties. And it's up to us. It's our government, and if it's not working, it's our fault and our responsibility to be ever more vigilant and make it work like it's supposed to.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I love that statement by Thomas Jefferson. He said, "In questions of power, then, let no more be said of the state of man, but bind him down with the change of the Constitution." And what has happened in the sense of, I'm just kind of wondering, my head's spinning. We had this union of 13 colonies that became states. They purposely knew what centralized power would do. They wrote a constitution to keep things small. We didn't have the Justice Department until 1870, the FBI until the late 20s and 30s. And it has grown into this thing that is, there was a 2011 Gallup poll. 49% of the American people believed that the federal government has become too big and poses a threat to everyday people. 49%. What is your view from studying history and the Constitution as far as the size of the federal government?
Well, it's beyond belief. But you fundamentally must understand that big government is extremely good, capable of doing one thing, and that is increasing the size, the power, the cost of big government. And it's up to us to keep it more under control. And last time I looked, the Ninth Amendment to the Bill of Rights, to the Constitution, is still in effect, and the Tenth Amendment is too. And what powers are not delegated by us, namely we the people, to the federal government are reserved for whom? Reserved for the people, reserved for the states. And you're mentioning, you know, we didn't have these various other agencies, the FBI, etc. We didn't have the Department of Education until Jimmy Carter's times around the early 1970s. We did very well. In fact, we did better without having a Department of Education. I ask the question frequently, who is in a better position to decide where and how your children should be educated, you as the parents or the federal government? And never do I have anybody say, oh, the federal government knows more than the parents. Get the federal government out of education. You can look through our Constitution, look through our history until the 1970s. The federal government has no place in education at all. Let's get them out of there and bring it back to the local level, the school districts and the parents, and we will reclaim what we used to have. When I was in public education in the 50s and 60s, we had excellence in our schools. The more the government gets involved, the worse things get, and that's transparently true. And now you look at it, numbers and numbers of our public schools are failing our children. We'll look at health care. When I was being raised
well,
in the
50s and 60s. I want to discuss education a little bit more.
Well, there's a lot to talk about.
I know. This is a real quick. I went to the local tea party, as I occasion, you know, once or twice a month, and they talked about Common Core.
Right. I was going to bring that up. Actually, just right now, Kelly, yeah, I received something at a tea party rally that I was at the other day. We're definitely going to do a full show on it, but yeah, let's definitely discuss that since the topic did come up.
Yeah,
but also,
real brief,
I do see there are some folks on the line and some that would like to chime in. We do want to give our guest most of the floor this evening since he'll only be with us for a limited time on the show, and we'll have time afterwards to bring on guests, and maybe the last 15 minutes before he has to go, we'll bring in some callers to he'd like to chat with them or ask any questions. So go ahead, Kelly. I didn't want to interrupt, but I've seen that in the switchboard, so I want to address that so they know I've seen him.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, yeah, I went to the tea party, and my son is in first grade, doing great, 97% reading exam. I'd love to brag about him. But what is going on with his educational future, Common Core, where federal government is going to provide computers for all the kids? They basically do your homework on the computer and in the computer and on internet, raise it for them. And it's a lot of nice conveniences for the teacher, less work, less money, and the parents don't have to review them, and then you can sneak in some political ideologies in. That's what's spooky about the Common Core system. We're going around to local school boards saying, are you guys aware of what this is? It's Jimmy Carter times 10. It's a failure, going to be a failure. Judge Grant, I totally agree. The more federal government gets involved, the more it messes things up.
Well, and it's true. And I was talking a lot about Governor Gary Johnson, and you mentioned him earlier. You know, he is really, from my standpoint, the hope for our country. You know, this man was a very successful entrepreneur. He started his own as a handyman company. He was the handyman and turned it into a construction company of 1,000 people in New Mexico that he owned and eventually sold it. No one lost their jobs. And then he became the two-term governor of New Mexico, very successful, as a Republican in a Democratic state, actually left the state with a $1 billion surplus and worked for our civil liberties, etc. And I kept calling him the most qualified person to be president that I know of. And I guess I said it a few too many times, so he asked me to be his running mate. So now what am I supposed to say? So, of course, the answer was yes. But this man, when he became governor of New Mexico, he told his advisors, he said, look, bring me the biggest problem that New Mexico has today, and let's start with that. And so they did, and they worked it down, and eventually, and the reason I got to know him, about the fourth on the list was the war on drugs, which was not working. He held a press conference and said he's conducted an audit, as he called it, of the war on drugs, not working, and he suggested changes. I met him that way. But this man will look at what the government is, realize its limitations, which are many, realize that it has literally usurped the power of the people, the power of the states, the power of the local governments. And I'm just so enamored with this man, not only for what he says, but what he actually accomplished while he was governor of New Mexico. So this is where we need to go. We need to bring that federal government down to where it's supposed to be, which is probably about maybe 60% of the size that it has right now.
Yeah, as governor, he was, I believe, a Republican. He it was a strong Democratic state as well, but he won, he got reelected. But he also, at the same time, he vetoed more bills than all the other governors combined.
You know, I think
vetoed.
That's right. And
yeah.
And in fact, my favorite one was, it was a lengthy bill. He sent it back to the legislature and said, you know something, I don't have time to look at all of this. Take it back. Submit it one by one, and I'll look at it, and it never came back. I mean, that's the way government's supposed to be, and that's the way it will be if we can convince him to run for president again in 2016. He is where we need to be. You know, libertarians are in the mainstream of American political thought. and I literally mean that, about 85% of the people, of the voters, are libertarians, that we're both financially responsible and socially accepting. And no one is going to accuse Ms. Pelosi or Governor or President Obama of being financially responsible, and no one's going to accuse people like Governor Romney of being socially accepting. But that's where most of the people are. That's where the mainstream is. That's where we are. All we need to do is be considered to be viable. Had we been in the presidential debates, I think that probably Governor Johnson would have won the election.
And is Governor Johnson, because I want to bring the topic into the floor, because I know it's important to a lot of the listeners of the audience, and we're working on having one of the people who was affected by this on next week, Justin Benick-Thomas, about the IRS scandal with the conservative organizations and folks being targeted by the IRS. I haven't heard anything, but that doesn't mean it does not exist. Has Mr. Johnson said anything on this? And if so, what was that? And two, what are your thoughts on that, Judge Grant?
Well, I haven't heard from Governor Johnson on this. You know, he's an athlete, and he trains for long bicycle races. He's actually climbing the tallest mountains in all seven continents. So I've been a little out of touch with him for a couple of weeks, and I don't know whether he said anything. But the idea that the now former head of the IRS takes the Fifth Amendment for actions that were going on under her reign is awfully discouraging. You know, but it's not surprising. You know, you go back to Nixon. I mean, you will have people use the FBI, the IRS, for their own political gains unless we have the protections in Congress and in the court system. And unfortunately, we have not, that they've been lacking. And we, the people, are the ones that are going to be suffering from this. But it's our responsibility, like I tried to say before. It's our government, and we must understand that it's our government, and it's our responsibility to be vigilant.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Judge Gray, you mentioned that one time you were a Republican for quite some time, actually. And then, you had a transition out of conscience. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, I did. In fact, I ran for Congress as a Republican in 1998. But with the passage of the so-called Patriot Act in the early 2000s, 2002, I could no longer, as a matter of conscience, be a part of any organization that would condone, much less assist, this direct attack on our civil liberties. And so I left the Republican Party, and I literally remember the time period involved. It took me about 16 seconds to decide that I am a libertarian. I believe in what libertarians stand for, which is freedom. And also responsibility. You know, those go hand in hand to the degree that, and I heard a young libertarian talking about this recently, and I wholeheartedly agree, yes, we have the Statue of Liberty in New York, and thank God for that. And we do stand for liberty, but we should also have a statue of responsibility, because libertarians believe in responsibility as well. And that is, of course, simply not present in Sacramento today, in California, where I'm from, or certainly in Washington, D.C. We must bring back responsibility at all levels of government. And when I was a federal prosecutor, like I said earlier, I ended up heading a unit prosecuting frauds against the government, and that included a lot of bank vice presidents for frauds on various people. So we just need to bring responsibility back to all levels of our society where it is now wanting.
And speaking of bringing Mr. Johnson back in the floor just a little bit, is that another thing I believe he's doing is going to be speaking at the at Pork Fest, P-U-R-C Fest, on June 22nd, which happens to be the same day as the United We Stand Festival, being done by the freeandequal.org, who, of course, as you know, Judge Gray, is looking to open up ballot access to parties such as the Libertarian Party. And so it's my understanding he has slotted to speak there, which unfortunately is the same date and time as the festival, the United We Stand Festival. So, you know, what's your thoughts on do you know a lot about what's going on there, or what do you know about?
Well, you know, I am proud to be a libertarian, and if people would really understand what we stand for, the Move On movement, for example, would gravitate toward us. We really do stand for liberal values. We really do stand for not paying people for drilling for oil, for example, you know, corporate welfare, for paying farm subsidies. I mean, the answer is no, that the corporate welfare is simply not what we believe in at all. We'd also, like I say, with the Tea Party, you know, where we can have responsibility at all levels of society, prosecute people for any violations. And the higher position of responsibility you have, the more accountability you should have. And that's what Governor Johnson and I certainly believe in. We believe in a strong military. But on the other hand, all of this activity that we put our troops into, during the campaign, probably one of the most sobering things that's happened to me on the campaign or in my lifetime, I was at Stanford University, and after I gave my presentation, this young man came up to me. He was about 6'3", good-looking young man, who was wearing a suit coat, and on his lapel, he had a Purple Heart ribbon and a Bronze Star. And I said, well, sir, where did you serve? And he said, well, sir, I served in the Marine Corps in the Gulf War. And then he looked at me square in the eye and said, you know, Your Honor, we will go where we are ordered. We will serve. We will sacrifice. Some of us will be killed, but please be our voice. Please make sure that where we're sent is important for our security. And I looked him in the eye and said, I will vow to you, I will do everything I can. Now, we didn't win the election, but we have our troops all over the world today fighting in these various conflicts that don't have anything to do with our security. And the answer is no. The answer is we will bring our troops home from Afghanistan now. We have troops fighting in Yemen, for heaven's sake, or Somalia or the Sudan. We don't need those troops there. It is inappropriate to have them fighting and sacrificing where it does not affect our security. So all of these things, if people would understand what we stand for, they will flock to the Libertarian Party and certainly Governor Gary Johnson.
Well, one thing I noticed about... Go ahead, Robert.
Well, I was just going to say, and one thing I want to bring up is about the United We Stand Fest there in Arkansas, Little Rock, Arkansas. Perhaps so. We can see if there's a slot open if you'd be interested in speaking there, but that's something we could talk off the line. I know Gary Johnson was invited, but it sounds like he has some engagements that were pre-existing. So.
Yeah, I've heard about that assembly in Little Rock, and I'd be happy to go if I can, if we can work it out. I think that would just be great.
Yeah, let me I'll speak with Christina Tobin on that and see if it's kind of serendipitous because it's literally 1 month from today. It's June 22nd in Little Rock, Arkansas. So, yeah, it's literally 1 month today, so maybe we can
set that aside on my calendar. If, in fact, it works, I'd love to go. We'll see if we can work out some details. But again, I just love to talk with people that understand these important issues and actually put themselves into the position of working on them. So count me in if we can work it out.
Awesome, and I'll see what we can get done with that. But you were also mentioning all the different places that the military is, and I think that's a good segue into one of the other topics I wanted to cover tonight, and we can, you know, go back and forth to the different ones. It's kind of an organic show, but, you know, we'd like to have a semblance of order. But since we brought this up, is I want to talk about Benghazi. It's something that's ringing its head again, and rightfully so.
Hey, Robert.
You know, yes.
Okay, I want to finish a little bit on or get his thoughts on the concept of Congress declaring war. I was on a conference call Sunday with somebody.
I'd like to move over to, yeah, we could do that. And then
Benghazi, absolutely, yeah.
Benghazi could discuss
yeah.
it. Go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah. So this guy, you know, he loves the Constitution, Tea Party, all that stuff. And, you know, we were having a good talk, and he's really thinking, Iran, you know, we need to have these preemptive strikes. And I'm like, hey, look, you know, if Congress would declare war, then we could have a preemptive strike. It's in the Constitution. Pretty much everything we want to do, we have to go through the constitutional process. It just takes more steps. So if Iran is truly indeed a threat, let Congress declare war, the president sign it, we go after him. And what's neat about this is the American people get to write and call their congressman and say, look, we do or we do not want to go to war. that's what the intent was. It's another step. But I just want to get Judge Gray's view on that.
That is a critically important issue. We went into this conflict, so-called, in Vietnam. It was illegal. You look at the Constitution, like you say, there's a difference between Congress, in effect, abrogating its responsibility and delegating it to the president to do whatever he or eventually she thinks is appropriate. No, no, no. It would take a declaration of war. It's a different instrument. It's in the Constitution for a very good reason, and there's a lot different for Congress voting to go to war as opposed to delegating that decision to the executive. So we never should have gone into Korea without a declaration of war, or Vietnam, or certainly not Iraq. It's different. And I was horrified to listen to the presidential debates between Mr. Obama and Mr. Governor Romney. And they were out trying to macho each other by who's going to bomb Iran first, who's going to go to war with Iran first. It's horrifying. Going into Iraq, from my standpoint, was the biggest mistake in my lifetime. It was terribly ill thought out. Saddam Hussein was not a good man, I agree with that, but he was not a security threat to the United States, and we knew it at the time. And Iran is not a security threat to us either. If they attack us or our allies, I assure you, under the Governor Gary Johnson administration and me, they will wish they had not. But unless they attack us or our allies, we're not going to attack anybody. We're going to declare peace in the world, and the world will be an awful lot better place. But woe to those folks that attack us. But we will not attack anybody without that declaration of war. It's simply fundamental and simply the wrong way to go without that declaration of war.
Well said. All right, Robert,
you were talking about Benghazi, and you know, it's a horrifying thing, and the more things seem to come out, yes, I think the Republicans are out for a witch hunt. You know, they're trying to smear Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, you know, for political reasons. And I'm not a politician, honestly. I'm a judge. I believe in reasonable laws. I believe in enforcing those laws. And I believe in getting along with others. Once the elections are over, let's work together for America. But it does appear that the State Department was fully aware that the Benghazi consulate was not protected. They were requesting help. They were saying this is a problem. And the response was woeful. And, of course, we lost our ambassador, which is a terrible human thing and a terribly demoralizing thing for our country. And I think our country has an absolute right to expect better from our elected and our appointed officials.
And do you think it went all the way up as far as the knowledge of Obama?
I do not have an answer to
that.
I just don't know. I'm not going to claim that Mr. Obama does not want, you know, good things for the United States. I just don't believe that. You know, I think he's doing his best. His vision is so much different than mine. But I certainly think that he had no intention of having bad things happen to the ambassador in Benghazi. But not well prepared, not well thought out. These things should not happen. These things should not happen.
And real quick, what about the IRS scandal? Do you think he had knowledge of that?
It's outrageous. I mean, but again, if you have a government out of control, you have the subpoenas for the Associated Press reporters. I mean, the government will overstep. Are you surprised? No, we need those checks and balances. We need people to be riding herd on these folks because power does corrupt, and we're getting more toward absolute power. You know, with the Patriot Act, the National Defense Authorization Act, giving enormous powers to the executive, and they're going to be abused. I mean, they're just going to be abused, and we need those protections. We need to bring back government to be under control and reduce in size and intrusion and a lot more responsible. Again, that's why I spent so much time applauding Governor Gary Johnson, because he's the guy. He will just bring that responsibility back. I'm doing everything I can to convince him to run again for president in 2016.
Well, there's a corollary to the power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Well, the corollary is simply this. Take away that power, make federal government smaller, and we can rest safer in our beds.
Well, and that's right. You know, we need a federal government, of course, for things like our military and that sort of thing, and for a currency. I acknowledge that, but the country is founded on the concept of federalism. What does that mean? It means allow each state to decide. In fact, I call them 50 crucibles of democracy, you know, 50 independent engines of democracy to decide how best to address these various issues of health care, of education, certainly the war on drugs, all of these things. And we'll have some spectacular successes that can be copied. And yes, I acknowledge maybe some states will go down the wrong path and be some rather substantial failures, but those will show things that can be avoided.
Mm-hmm.
I talk with people all the time, and I'll ask them a question. I'll ask our listeners a question right now. How many of you believe that the federal government has all the answers? Well, I'm looking around through the telephone wires here, and nobody's raising their hand. Of course not, because they know
yeah.
that that's the case. Let's let each state decide how best to serve and protect its people and bring the decision-making back to a more local level, and then we'll be able to emulate success and avoid failure.
Well, Judge, let me ask this question. What were the duties in regarding the law enforcement? I mean, there's only like three or four real main duties of the federal government historically until all these alphabet soup agencies came in. What's your understanding of what, from the Constitution, what the federal government was limited to actually do?
Well, and that's simply written in the Constitution, you know, and it's there. You know, and then it says again that you don't any powers that are not delegated by this instrument to the people are reserved for the states. So you can look at that Constitution and see pretty much where you want to go. Article 1, Section 8 is a really good place to start.
Yeah, I was under the understanding that Donald Sheldon, he's chairman of the Broward County Libertarian Party. Hopefully he'll call in. But when he was going to school, the teacher said, look, as far as law, the federal government's only going to prosecute treason, tax evasion, and I think one other thing. That's what he was taught in the 50s and the 60s. And now it's come to the point where with, say, the war on drugs and DHS and yada, yada, they can look into your bank account, Patriot Act, NDA. They can look. They can do whatever they want to us. Whereas, what Donald was taught was all other crimes are prosecuted by the state you live in under the state laws.
And that's absolutely right. I mean, it's clear that taking a gun and holding up a liquor store is a terrible offense or murder. I mean, it's just a heinous offense, but it's not a federal offense. That doesn't demean it. It just means, though, jurisdictionally, it stays within the province of the state. And the prosecutions for federal offenses, and I was a federal prosecutor in Los Angeles, and I know these things, you know, they should be limited. They must be limited. And, of course, the federal government doesn't have the resources to prosecute street crime, nor should it. You know, it's meant to prosecute big-time interstate fraud cases, matters of that kind, and that's appropriate. If they're going conducting fraud over interstate lines, then that's a federal offense. But otherwise, leave those to the state. But the states have had their power usurped, literally, by the federal government. And now, of course, and again, we haven't talked much about the war on drugs, but the federal government is literally bribing the various state and city police departments to continue with the war on drugs, that they will give them grant money, but there's a string or a rope or a chain attached to it. You have to use these millions of dollars to pursue the war on drugs, drug prohibition, which is outright stupid, but that's what they do because they have all of, by the way, our money. We need to reduce that money that goes to the federal government. The government needs to reduce its spending and bring it back down to size, and everybody will be better off except, of course, the federal government.
And real quick, gentlemen, I believe we do have Mr. Sheldon on the line as we speak, so I will open up this mic. Mr. Sheldon, thank you for coming to the show. How are you?
I'm wonderful, and I appreciate your time and letting me on this air. I am Judge Gray. I was an advocate and a supporter of Gary Johnson. I'm a Libertarian Party chairman of Broward County, which is a huge county here in southern Florida, which you may know. Fort Lauderdale's got a million registered voters, not very many of whom are, unfortunately, are Libertarians, but it is a potential gold mine for us as a Libertarian Party. And the a couple of things I wanted to say. My background, by the way, is Wall Street, and particularly public finance. And at the state and local level, I consider that the access to the credit markets that we have given our local governments has been one of the greatest things that we have ever done as a society. I mean, the accessing when a mayor can determine whether or not he's going to borrow money to, with the permission of the voters, to borrow money for public improvement, it makes us just such a powerful society that it's almost unbelievable. Anyway, regardless of that, let me just say to you that I was a Republican and became a Libertarian when I was locked up for contempt of court, for civil contempt of court, and saw the tragedy of the drug war firsthand. I mean, it was just so heartbreaking to see these young men being brought in and turned into convicted felons for just virtually no reason whatsoever, except just being caught up in the grind of wheel of what we call a justice system, which is, I don't need to tell you, sir, you know firsthand how horrible that is. And it really is a horror show. I became what I call just a jailhouse lawyer and helped a few of them, but there are so few that you can actually do anything for. And, you know, I have said to people, by the way, I'm a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Those guys know where the rubber meets the road. They have been enforcement people, mostly all of them, and they understand the horror that the drug war really is. And it truly is just that, you know, that. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, now, I've supported you and Gary Johnson during the campaign, but I was just ashamed at how little money we were able to raise to put behind you. I mean, it was just a disgrace, sir. I apologize to you for it. What I'm suggesting to you, though, is, you know, as I say, my background is Wall Street, and what Wall Street does is brings buyers and sellers of money together, and we just didn't raise any money for you. It was just like, why? What's going on? Why doesn't the Libertarian Party bring in more funds for people like yourself who deserve to be elected?
Well, Mike, and thank you. And you know, you're doing good work down there, and we're all aware of Fort Lauderdale and where you are in your Brown County. And I am also a speaker for LEAP and have been for decades, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. They really don't know what to make of us because we have all the credentials, obviously not soft on crime. And like you say, with regard to drug prohibition, I was pretty much a drug warrior when I was in the Navy and when I was a federal prosecutor. Didn't really think about it much, but was raised pretty much like everyone else to equate, for example, heroin with bad, with evil, with prison. But then when I was a judge, I just see us churning low-level drug offenders through the system for no good purpose, ruining people's lives, the so-called remedy being far worse than the so-called disease. And then as Governor Johnson says, you know, about 90% of the drug problems are drug prohibition problems. They're drug money problems. And yes, I'm not minimizing the drug problems, but that's only about 10% of the issue. And just ask the people of Mexico, for example. You know, you've lost about 60,000 people in Mexico in the last 5 years to violent deaths. Not caused by drugs, has nothing to do with drugs. It has everything to do with drug money. So exactly. That's where we are. And you talk about money. You know, people will only usually invest money if they feel that you're going to win. And again, that's where we had to have been a part of the presidential debates. Now, we were outspent 10 by 1,000 to 1, and we got about, 1% of the vote. So we got, you know, one one-hundredth of the vote for spending one one-thousandth of the money. But if we can be in the debates in 2016 and get Governor Johnson there, the money will come. Because not only people will gravitate toward what we talk about, but we have something that people would not only want but crave, and if they see it's possible, would demand. And that is, we'll put in a coalition government. You know, Mike, we will put in a government, of course, of independents and libertarians, but also Republicans and Democrats, then when we have this polarization going on, this mindless politics, we talk to some of our own people in the administration that are part Republicans or Democrats or whatever, saying, go out, talk to your colleagues, get them on board. We'll give credit to anybody that has a good idea. Anybody that embraces a good idea will all work for America. And that's what people will want, and that's what we deliver. Again, being in the mainstream of American political thought, because we're both financially responsible, and most people are, and socially accepting, and again, most people are that too. So thanks for what you're doing, and stay tuned. We're going to get Governor Johnson back in this race, and we're going to change the face of our country.
Well, I wanted to, you know, this was war on drugs thing. I'm having a paradigm shift, okay? I don't use drugs. You know, I drink some wine. But I was watching a History Channel, and they were talking about the gangsters during Prohibition. Al Capone, he had the South Side of Chicago. Beer was known as 7 cents before. During Prohibition, it was 70 cents. He was making big bucks. He wanted to wipe out the northern competitor, which was the Ritchie part of Chicago. And the violence that came out of that was the Valentine's Day Massacre. The northern gang, the seven people, they were all shot dead. They couldn't frame Capone. But I realized, oh, my gosh, alcohol is a lot harder to hide because you got these stills and breweries and these big buildings. It's a lot harder than to enforce than, you know, like say, for example, marijuana in states are going that way. But what I realized is, hey, wait. Crime, death, problems, and then, wait, no. Capone had it really easy because he was bribing government officials. I started to have this paradigm shift at least to let the war on drugs be decided by individual states, because this whole drug war has failed. Created criminals, corrupted people. What's your thoughts on all this?
Well, and you're certainly right. And by the way, I'll question your terminology a little bit. I always say alcohol prohibition, and I really wish we'd never done that, would not have given people like the Mafia and Al Capone a foothold or a leg hold in our country. Because today we're living in drug prohibition with the same results. So prohibition doesn't work. And the other thing that you look at, people, if you ask them, how many people here believe that we're in better shape today in our country as to the issue of drug abuse and all the crime and misery that goes with it? Nobody will raise their hands. They all realize we're not making progress. Well, then the first realization after that is we have no legitimate expectation of being in better shape next year than we're in today unless we change our approach. So let's go back to what we did when we finally came to our senses and repealed alcohol prohibition. And when that happened, we did not say that Nebraska or New Jersey or anywhere will serve alcohol. Like you're saying, we just left it to individual states. And some states decided to stay dry, fine. Other states decided to go to the package stores, and some, like Pennsylvania, still do. And that's fine, too. And you restricted the federal involvement simply to assist each state in enforcing its chosen laws. And then we will work out what we'll see what works and what doesn't work. But this, again, is a usurpation. When we made alcohol illegal, it took the 18th Amendment, by the way, to make it illegal. And then, of course, the 21st Amendment repealed it. But then the federal government around 1913 with the Harrison Narcotics Act was really smart, or wily, as you might say. They did not prohibit the narcotics. They just made it a tax issue. So they said, you know, you can still sell cocaine if you want to. And of course, it was legal before 1913. But if you sell $10 worth of cocaine, we'll slap a $30 tax on it. And if you don't pay the tax, we'll prosecute you. And they did the same thing with the Marijuana Tax Act in 1932. You know, same deal. You could sell all the marijuana you wanted to, but they slapped on a huge tax. And if you don't file the cumbersome forms and pay the taxes, they'll prosecute you. It wasn't until 1971 with Richard Nixon that we first made these drugs illegal. We prohibited them with the Controlled Substances Act, but by that time people were so conditioned for it. And it's a disaster, unmitigated disaster. And I'd ask you, I'd ask our listeners, if we were to give cocaine away on every street corner for free and bless it by every religious leader in town. How many of you are going to jam cocaine up your nose? You know, I'm not. I have enough trouble with my cholesterol, for heavens. I care about what I put into my body, and most people are the same way. And by the way, if some people are out there saying, yes, I'd use it, they're probably using it already. So today it's easier for our young people to get cocaine if they want to, or marijuana if they want to, that's the key, than it is alcohol. Why? Because there's no controls whatsoever. So the biggest oxymoron in our lives today is literally the term controlled substances. Because as soon as you prohibit something, you give up all of your control to the bad guys, to the Mexican drug cartels, to the juvenile street gangs and other thugs, and they control who's going to get it. There's no age restrictions. There's no quality control. There's no quantity control or, you know, sale or pricing or anything. We give it up to the bad guys. We couldn't do it worse if we tried. Governor Gary Johnson had the fortitude in 1999 as the governor of New Mexico to stand up. He had no constituency for this, but it was the right thing to do. And he said, this isn't working. Let's put our heads together and come up with something better. This is the man that will lead our country out of so many problems in health care, in education, with our military conflicts, with our government spending, with the drug prohibition. It goes on, and I'm proud to be connected with him.
Well,
real quick, gentlemen, while we have him on the line, is that what I would like to do, and we asked this of Mr. Gray, so I'd like to also bring into the conversation as well, is that we were talking earlier about, of course, you know, current issues such as the IRS scandal and Benghazi. So what I'd really like, you know, right now, if you can give us your thoughts on that. First, we'd start with the IRS scandal. Now, what's your thoughts on that? And then we'll move over on to hear your thoughts on Benghazi.
Well, I tried earlier to talk about the IRS, and I tried earlier to talk about Benghazi. You know, I don't have any particular information about what Mr. Obama knew or directed or otherwise, but the allegations here, and certainly the head of the IRS taking the Fifth Amendment, I mean, of course, in trial we're not supposed to comment on that, but as voters we certainly can. It's just disgusting. Mm-hmm. But it's a government out of control. There's no regulations, and the government is not doing its job. So they're usurping powers in so many areas and expanding their power and control and, of course, size and wealth, but they're not doing their job where they're supposed to. I mean, we have today somewhere between 900 and 1,000 military reservations or bases around the world. And, you know, if they're necessary for our security, fine, keep them, reinforce them as far as that's concerned. But I'll wager that at least 80% of them are not necessary for our security. Just ask yourself the question, do you think Germany is going to be attacked by Austria in our lifetimes? Why do we have troops still in Germany? Very expensive for us. We can't afford it. We just make the Germans mad at us. It's just not working. Should we have troops in Japan? I don't think so. Troops in Korea, in South Korea, yes, I think we should have some, but not nearly the number that we have there, and all around the world, in Spain, etc. Again, if they're necessary for our security, keep them, but let's otherwise bring these troops home and have them be in Kansas or San Francisco or New Jersey or someplace and spend our money here at home and take our troops out of harm's way. The world will be a safer place, and so will we.
But no, just what I wanted to do, and I want Judge Gray to reiterate, because I know saying earlier, you know, what the thoughts are on it. I just wanted to get everyone on the line here an opportunity to make comment on it.
Well, what were you asking us to comment on?
I'm sorry?
This is Donald Sheldon. I was asking, what were you asking us to comment on?
Yeah, I guess there was a little mix up. I was asking your thoughts on the IRS scandal and the Benghazi. Because I know we earlier in the show we asked Mr. Gray.
Let me say to you, Judge Gray, I appreciate your reluctance to make comments about, say, a president and his duties, the fact of how it is, however, that it seems to me that the information that we're getting leads one to the conclusion that the White House had to be involved at least at some point and has to know a lot more than it's willing to admit and has made mistakes in here and is trying to cover them up. Now, the cover-up is really more important than the actual mistakes. If they had been honest with us and were, you know, today honest with us, I think most Americans would forgive them. I do not think that it's forgivable, however, to handle the situations as they are currently being handled by this administration. And whether or not you believe or don't believe that they had information, it seems to me very logical to think that, you know, there's no way in the world that they could not have been aware of what was going on here, and that they were strictly, particularly in Benghazi, playing politics, claiming that the war on terror was over, and that because we had captured Osama bin Laden, this president deserved credit for ending that war. And it was just a lie, a complete and total lie. And you know, and it will remain so forever. There's no way to get around that. And he got himself elected president by a margin.
Donald, there's no such thing as a war on terror. You can't declare war on an idea or a tactic.
I agree with
any
that.
More than you can declare war on poverty or war on drugs, which are just things. But I'll let the system take its course. I think it's a lie to the American people. And I think the American people have a right to expect that their elected officials or any officials will tell them the truth. Now, they don't have to always be candid. You know, there are such things as state secrets. But when asked a direct question, particularly under penalty of perjury, I think we have an absolute right to get the truth.
Well, we will eventually get there. And as a matter of fact, as you very well know, because of this book that, that Kelly has put out, we will get grand juries asking for indictments and looking into things with the right to ask questions under penalty of perjury. I'm not sure whether the Congress has the courage to do so or not, but I think that the American people deserve and will get that. But you know, regardless of that, I agree with you entirely that we can't have government lying to us. You know, there's just no way. That's not acceptable behavior. Now, let me switch back to you because the war on drugs has been my topic for the last 3 years. I think it's over. And by the way, I think it's over because Bill Clinton and Morgan Freeman are out there with a 54-minute video saying that we must re-examine the whole premise for the war on drugs. I don't think that these men, either one, are – I think they're both master politicians. And I think they're getting in front of a wave that's an idea that's time has come. The end of the drug war is now, and I think that you've been on the right side of it, obviously, for a long time. But
Kelly here. Yeah, I want to move into some social issues, if you will, or socially accepting issues. But I did want to make a quick comment. There are no gangs killing each other over aspirin territories. You know, it's just the crime is bad. I wanted to throw out, you know, federalism is believing the states can take care of their own business, write their own laws. And as Judge Gray probably knows, the 13 colonies became states on July 4th, 1776. Articles of Confederation, 1778, each state retains its own sovereignty. Later on, 1788, we had the Constitution, and then later on we had the Bill of Rights, Article 10. You've cited it, which you get an A, by the way. I always quiz people running for office or any kind of political position, do you know the 10th Amendment, states' rights? And I firmly believe, and I'm going to ask you where you are on a few issues, but I firmly believe the federal government doesn't have any business in so many social issues. Leave it in the hands of the states. Here's a point from Harry Brown's book, Liberty A to Z. It says, he wrote in under abortion, the Constitution gives the federal government no authority to deal with the common crimes, murder, theft, and so on, in any way. In fact, only three crimes are mentioned in the Constitution, treason, piracy, and counterfeiting. So obviously there is no authority for the federal government to legislate on abortion in any way. By the way, he won the Libertarian nomination twice. He goes on to say this, point number seven, I am anti-abortion and anti-government. If I were president, my anti-abortion feelings would be irrelevant because the federal government should have nothing to do with the subject. So my position, yeah, my position with all these social issues is federal government hands off, let the states decide. Murder, capital punishment, different in all the states. Some have it, some don't. So I don't believe the federal government should be in the womb, the bedroom, or the vein. Let the states decide. I just want to know what your thoughts were on that.
Well, the answer is, of course, amen is my answer. And Harry Brown was just a wonderful man, a great leader, a great thinker, and one who had an awful lot of integrity. So I'm proud to be in the party of David Nolan and David Berglund and Harry Brown. You know, we have reason to be proud, but the federal government again just goes unchecked, and so it will continue to gain in power until the people stand up. You know, it was Thomas Jefferson that said that we really need a revolution every generation. Otherwise, the government will continue to usurp power. And he was right. Where has that revolution been? Look at what has happened since that time. And it's time for us to stand up and bring back our country. If only the biggest security threat to our country is a failing economy. And that's where we're going with all of this spending, not only spending, but borrowing and printing money. That literally, for every dollar the federal government is now spending today in 2013, we're borrowing or printing 30 cents. I mean, no company can do that and stay in existence. No household can do that without going through bankruptcy. And let me tell you a secret, neither can any country. And so it's my generation that's done this, and Harry Brown's generation, too. And it's our children that are going to have to pay it back, and our grandchildren are bankrupt. And it's our doing. Shame on us, and we are leading our country and our future astray. So Harry Brown stood up for this. Governor Johnson and I'm trying to stand up for this. We need to get this word out. And I'm comfortable and confident that the people, when they see this dire threat, will understand literally that the libertarians are the way home.
Well, yeah, Harry Brown put another brilliant short point. He said, so you want the federal government to be deciding what is morality? Well, one group's in power, they put in God's law. What about the next group? When they get in power, are they going to put in Satan's law? He has no business in the moral issues. And so, you know, the more we go to the feds to solve our problems, i.e. social issues, the bigger it gets, and it's a dismal failure. And let's suppose, I want to give a couple examples. Suppose Missouri passes a pro-life position and California says pro-abortion position. Well, should Missouri be telling California what to do, or California telling Missouri? Heck no, but they try through the federal government. Then you got Massachusetts, they passed making it legal for homosexual marriage. Should Massachusetts tell Texas you're going to have legal homosexual marriages? But people do this through the federal government, and all it does is make the federal government into a bigger monster than it already is.
Amen.
You're absolutely right on that. Judge, let me run something by you here that has come to my attention here recently. I am, as I said to you, a background of Wall Street, and I'm a background also of a Republican, and I'm also a background of a conservative. And so with all these things in mind, I will say to you that I am about to change some of my positions on some things along these lines in the economic area. And the reason is because, you know, we've been rabidly talked about the fact that we have scarcity of things like oil and gas and energy and all that sort of thing. And all of a sudden, I've become aware that we don't have a scarcity of anything. I mean, we keep finding ways as human beings. I'll tell you where I think we have a scarcity. I think we have a scarcity in acknowledging the fact that every human life is an asset to the planet. I mean, you know, we were told just two generations ago, 40 years ago, that we would by now be starving to death because we wouldn't be able to feed the population of the earth. Well, that's not even close to being true. I mean, we have no question that our technology is allowing us not only to feed, but feed better. for longer periods of time, a population that is expanding. The human species is getting larger in numbers every single day. And now, what does that mean? It means that somehow or another, we're ingenious enough to be able to feed not only ourselves, but our future generations. And, you know, I think that we may be about to just explode with economic activity, regardless of the fact that I think this guy's an idiot in the White House and has no idea what economics even really is. But the fact is that we as human beings are able to bounce around the terror of congressional regulation and continue to expand our economy. It's amazing to me, and by the way, counterintuitive to what I've always believed. But now I'm beginning to think that regardless of the fact that this man is a horrible economic influence, we are going to thrive. No, we're not even survive. We're going to thrive as a human species and be an asset to the universe, not just to the planet. We're going to move off this darn planet and I'm beginning to be very optimistic.
To land on Mars. We're supposed to like to have someone on Mars by 2016, but with the way Obama's decimated NASA, I don't know if that's going to be something we'll definitely want to say 2016.
The fact that Obama has fouled up the government's participation in that is the greatest
thing
that could ever happen. We get private enterprise in there.
Market, that's true.
I was wondering if you'd get around to that, because private industry will do an awful lot better than NASA ever has and for a lot less money. But
exactly.
Like you're saying, you know, ingenuity, technology changes. As long as you have a system that rewards ingenuity, we're going to be able to figure out ways to resolve all of these problems. And
you're absolutely right.
I'm convinced of that. It's the government that sets up. You know, we have more regulations that the Obama administration has thrown on us. Even in Bush, and George W. Bush did a lot too. But in 4 years of the Obama administration, he did more regulations than Bush in eight. You know, we need some regulations. I'm not saying that we don't, but they're mindless. We've got to streamline them. We've got to stop all of this bureaucracy, because I tell you, bureaucracy is really good at justifying its existence and causing more people simply to respond, to fill out more forms and stop everything. If you go to the FDA, you know, the Federal Food and Drug Act, and you get these folks, they have every reason, if you are a regulator, to say no. Why? Well, if you approve 10 drugs and 9 of them go on and they help people and they save lives and they make life better, but one of them causes people some harm or whatever, your head will roll. You know, you won't get credit for having approved those, but the one you'd approve that caused any problems will keep you from advancement. So you have every reason to say no, to kick it upstairs, to kick it downstairs, to delay, because that's the nature of government. And that's true in every bureaucracy that we have. They justify their existence, they throttle people, and they stifle creativity and government, and entrepreneurship. Again, we need some regulation, but it's vastly, vastly overdone. We need to bring it back into check.
I don't think we can bring it back into check without having it move away from our government. And by that, I mean we have areas of the world in which there is no regulation or very little. And that's where the expansion of the economies is going to occur. You know, we've lost our Wall Street no longer is the heart of the economic world. It just is gone. We're down to like 17% of the initial public offerings of the world. They're gone to Asia. And they, by the way, even to Canada. People are going to Canada, of all places, to do initial public offerings. It's ridiculous.
Wow.
But the fact is that's what's happening.
Let me bring it back into perspective in healthcare, because what you say is correct. And there's two areas in healthcare, even today, where you or I or anybody can get really good quality health care for reasonable competitive prices. What are they? Number one, it's LASIK eye surgery, and number two is cosmetic surgery. Why? Because the government is not involved. The insurance companies are not involved. So the customers go to the providers, to the entrepreneurial doctors, and they, you know, come to Dr. Gray. I've done this LASIK eye surgery 25,000 times. I'll give you good credit payment schedules, all that sort of thing. That's the way it was when I was growing up. Nobody was saying we didn't have good quality health care for reasonable prices. Wasn't even a topic of conversation. We weren't closing emergency rooms, but then the government gets more and more involved, first with Medicare and now with virtually everything else. If you want your health care to be run by your local Department of Motor Vehicles, you're well on your way. It's simply galloping in the wrong direction, and that's true in health care. It's true in education. It's true with pretty much everything. Doesn't mean we don't need government, but we need a whole lot less government and an awful lot more responsibility, and that's where we are going to lead the world back to sanity and prosperity.
I think you're absolutely right, and particularly in the medical field, alternative medicine is becoming the byword of everyone who's got sense enough to stay away from the FDA and the horrors of that. Frankly, that the government has put on us with medicines that just, you know, what I say to doctors, and I say this to several of them, if anything has a side effect of occasionally causing death, you can forget me. I mean, you know, I'm not sure what the upside is, but occasional death is not what I'm looking forward to. I don't know what occasional means either, by the way. I don't think there's a legal definition for occasional death.
Occasional means when it happens to somebody else.
Indeed. Real quick, gentlemen, as I said, we've had some folks on the line, and it's a little bit over the top of the hour. So for the folks who are listening in and would like to call, just five, I almost gave my home phone. You can call in. It's 347-945-7428. And for those of you who are on the phone lines calling in, you'd like to chime in, just push 1 on your number dial. And, of course, there are those listening from Skype. So if you'd like to, you can either send me a message via the chat on Blog Talk Radio, or you can also send me a message through Facebook to chime in. And once again, I'd like to thank all those coming with to the live portion of the show, whether you're listening here from Blog Talk Radio or some of the other venues that you can listen live on this show. And also, thank you for listening to the archive as well. So as I said, it's just the top of the hour, and we will bring it to you, Kelly. We haven't heard from you for a little bit, or the gentleman can let them finish up, and then we'll move over to you. And go ahead, guys.
Well, I'm just really excited. You know, a little over a year ago, I really wasn't a libertarian, but I absolutely believe now the principles they stand for, which of course is liberty, smaller government, et cetera, et cetera. But just one more point. You know, I'm a big states' rights guy. The most important issue morally regarding the states and the federal government is simply this: the sovereignty of each state. That, I think, is a sacred thing that should never be touched. The sovereignty of all 50 states on all social, you know, federal welfare, get it out. Get it in the hands of the states. You want to do health care? You know, in Massachusetts, God bless it, you know. But like Judge Gray said, you know, one state might fail. Well, we can actually learn a lot instead of an experiment at the federal level that could be a dismal destruction to our country. So that's kind of my thing is, this, of course, states' rights and the grand jury. But we had a long series on that, too, with the states' rights.
Well, Kelly, this is Gray again, but you're simply right, and I can't stress more strongly enough that our country was founded on the concept of federalism to allow each state to decide how best to support and protect its people. And the federal government does not have all the answers. Yes, I do not want the state of New Jersey to have its own army and the state of Pennsylvania to put up barriers for taxes on goods coming in from that sort of thing on other states. But otherwise, it is the states that will bring back the excellence and the creativity and the whole crucible of figuring out what's best for the most number of people. And it may be that in Oklahoma, a different drug policy would work better there than in Pennsylvania or in New York. So let them do it. It's simply the right way to go. And by the way, I've got about another 5 minutes, and then I'm going to have to move on. But it's been a pleasure being with you in this evening, and thank you for all you guys are doing, because you are really talking about the issues that we need to address, and we need to change again to make our country retrieve that prosperity, that equal opportunity, and that greatness that are now slipping through our fingers.
And real quick before you go, though, I do have someone on the line who just messaged me. Is the Arkansas caucus leader at Free and Equal, Mr. Dugan King, on the line. And he would like to ask you a quick question. You have a few minutes for that?
I do.
Okay, great. Mr. King, I opened up your line. Thank you very much for calling into the show.
Yes, thank you, Robert. And Judge Gray, we met in Little Rock when you campaigned in Little Rock at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock.
And I do remember, I was in Fayetteville. It was a great time, and enjoyed being there.
And my question is on this thing about states' rights and about the Constitution. I think I have an interesting solution to, you know, restoring states' rights. You know, the Constitution, the 10th Amendment, basically reserves to the states and to the people all residual power that wasn't specifically granted. How many powers did we grant, you know? And the Constitution is basically, it's a compact between the states, according to Jefferson, and when he wrote in the Kentucky Resolutions. The Constitution is a compact between the states. So I think the problem is that the Constitution is something that the states or the people have to enforce on the federal government. It's not something that the federal government enforces on itself. So I think one of the mistakes in the Constitution, they weren't real sure about how a republic would really work, so they kept like one toe in a monarchic state, and that was with the Supreme Court. You got 9 people appointed for life by the president, and now today, that's why we no longer go by the Constitution, because they think that they are the living Constitution, and therefore that's why Judge Roberts is saying that Obamacare is constitutional. When they're just, mate, that's an amazing interpretation. You know, the states can take care of their own health care. I'm like Jefferson. I would rather have county republics. And so the solution I see here is the Supreme Court. That, you know, that's a branch of the federal government. Are we going to let allow the fox to guard the hen house? Isn't it a conflict of interest that the Supreme Court can interpret the Constitution under Madison versus Marbury, and it's kind of like we're asking the federal government to regulate themselves when the people, we're supposed to do it, and the tool that we have for doing it is our state governments. You know, that the state is the check and the balance against the federal government. But with the Civil War and the loss of states' rights, we threw states' rights out in the bathwater with slavery. The slavery, we needed to get rid of that, but as far as the states being empowered to be the check and the balance on the federal government, now the federal government has slipped out of their restraint. So my resolution is that we quit appointing 9 Supreme Court justices and we allow every state to elect the Supreme Court justice, one from each state, and they decide what the Constitution means. And if the people don't like how their judges vote on that, they can elect them, they can get rid of them out of office. You don't want some idiot like Judge Roberts being the chief of the Supreme Court for life. That's what I think the solution is. Let's have 50 state elected judges be our Supreme Court and be the check and the balance on this federal government and give us a strict construction of the Constitution the way Jefferson and Madison envisioned it.
Well, that's certainly an intriguing idea, and I'd like to ponder it a bit, but certainly life is complicated as well, and you're going to have some human beings making some decisions because constitutions don't decide things on their own. But I think you raise some valid points, and what's happening today you know, don't get me started on the Citizens United case. It's just, I don't know what Scalia would have been thinking when he would do this.
Yeah.
And numbers of other Supreme Court cases, too. You can certainly go through all these drug cases that I've written a book called Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed, as you mentioned in the introduction, and have a whole chapter on United States Supreme Court cases involving drugs and how we have lost our civil liberties because of the war on drugs. Are we in better shape now because of that? Absolutely not. And once you give up your civil liberties to the government, you virtually never get them back. And again, it's our own soul for our country that's under attack. So, you know, all of these issues are extremely important to raise. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be involved with you. And if I can go to your free and equal thing on June 22nd in Little Rock, I'd love to go back again. I hope we can work that out. But one way or the other, good for you folks. We need to be vigilant. We need to reinforce what makes our country great in the first place, and that is our civil liberties, our freedoms, and our entrepreneurship, and our humanity, because people in the United States are humane, and we will do things not because we have to, but because we want to, because that's who we are. So I think we're all kind of Peace Corps volunteers in that fashion. So again, thank you. Look forward to being with you again sometime, and good luck to us all.
Did you get an invitation to Free and Equal?
I'm not sure, but not a formal one yet. We'll see if we can work something out.
Okay, I can be happy to get your name thrown in the pot if it isn't already.
Well, a lot of people want to put my name all kinds of places, but I'd love to come if I can.
I didn't mean it. I meant to throw your head in our ring. So.
Okay. Take care, good night, and good luck to us all.
All right.
Thank you, too. Take care. You know, it's great coming on. I do look forward, definitely, to speaking with Mr. Judge Gray again. And we have not heard from Kelly for a bit, so I'd like to open up the line to you, Kelly, and then we'll go over to Donald Sheldon. And then we will bring you back, Dugan. And then we've got some other folks in the line. So if you would like to chime in, just push 1 on your number dial. Or if you just want to listen, that's fine too. Or if you're on Skype or anything of that nature, just send me a message via Facebook or the chat. And if you happen to have my text, you can text me as well. Let me know to open up the line. So go ahead, Kelly.
Oh, I just think that was a wow. I just really... You know, when he speaks, he means what he says. You can see, you can hear the conviction he has deep in his soul. I just thought that was just awesome to have him on there. And, you know, I actually met him in person at the California State Libertarian Convention back in April. And he, you know, he spent a little time with me and just talked a little bit, just kind of, hey, how you doing? You know, we talked a little bit, and I gave him a copy of my book, and he actually said he'd read it, so. We'll see, but he's very busy, of course. He likes to read on airplanes. So, you know, obviously this guy keeps learning and learning and learning. I am so glad he got states' rights, you know, when he said amen, when he wholeheartedly agreed, because we just got to get – we got to take care of our own in each state, and then the federal government will be put in its place, and I really believe we'll prosper. I don't know how much more I can add to Judge Gray's words right now.
I think this is Donald Sheldon. I'd like to just step in here. And Kelly, I want to point out to you that, you know, I think that you've been such a great asset to the community and such a great asset to the society, bringing to our attention the power of the people and how we can use the grand jury to restrict the power of government, and how that is literally the fourth hidden branch of government. Your book is well written, it's well founded, and it's an absolute necessity for all of us to be aware of how we can indeed bring back to the people the power that is innately theirs and should always have been theirs. I think that...
Donald, why don't you tell us what you're going to be doing next week?
Well, next week, what I'm going to be doing, well, we've got number one, this coming week, starting actually this Friday, we have a state convention here in Florida for the Libertarian Party. And as I have said, I'm currently the chairman of the Broward County Libertarian Party. The state of Florida is really a huge state. It has a lot of people in it. Matter of fact, I think we're about, as a state, I think we've got half the population of the country of Canada right here in Florida. And I think, by the way, a lot of them are Canadians too. So, you know, regardless of that, the state of Florida is a powerful, powerful state. And we're looking forward to having some interesting things happen down here. I've been working diligently to get some things going that are really fascinating. One of our, for the last 3 years, Broward County has been working toward ending the war on drugs. And you know, I do seriously think, as I said in our conversation earlier, that with Bill Clinton stepping out here and talking about the reconsidering the war on drugs, I think this man is I disagree with many of his policies, but he's a master politician. And I think that the Democrats are swinging around, moving toward eliminating this, simply because, you know, it was FDR that ended prohibition of alcohol. In fact, he got himself elected in 1932 on a platform that said, "Vote for me and I'll set you free." And I think that's what's going to happen here. Indeed, what I'm suggesting to the Libertarian Party is that we be the party that not only has, well, we have been for some time toward eliminating prohibition, but I think we need to now talk about expunging the record of those people who have been serving time and have been convicted felons on drug charges in their lives. And it's a huge, huge problem to be a convicted felon.
You're talking about some of the minor users. You know, I read a grand jury report from Indiana. There was a county there, and they wrote to the state legislature. This is the grand jury. I can't remember. Yeah, Hancock County, I think it was. And basically they said, look, you ought to let, and this is Indiana, very conservative, you know, Christian kind of base. And the grand jury said, look, hey, you know what? You're plugging up our courts. You should allow people to have just a little bit of marijuana because you're plugging up the grand jury's time, the whole prosecution, the judges and everything. And meanwhile, we can't keep the bad guys off the streets and the jail cells empty for them. And I didn't say this, the grand jury did. I mean, like, oh, my gosh. So that's another problem. The civil cases, oh, my gosh, it takes years. Why? Because the judges aren't available. And then you're going to have another hearing. You're going to wait longer before the judge's availability. Then you have another hearing. It's plugging our courts up with civil cases. I was an expert witness in one, so waiting for the jury results. But, my gosh, what happened to justice? People go bitter when they don't get justice. They don't get bitter. They suck at work. I mean, you know, creativity is stifled, entrepreneurship, et cetera, et cetera. We got to do something with our courts, and unplug them is a good start.
Well, I think that, you know, I will guarantee you, absolutely guarantee you, that the moment we end prohibition, we will absolutely unclog the society in a way that's just going to be it's going to be phenomenal. I mean, it really will be. And it will not at all increase the use of drugs in this country. I'm convinced that you know, Americans are not going to change their way of living. They're just not going to do it. And I would assure you that the biggest promotion that we ever did of alcohol was prohibition. And I think that we got the same exact situation going in our drug culture today. Prohibition is what drives the use of drugs. It does not discourage it at all. It absolutely drives the use. And so,
well, there was a study, Donald, before they started the war on drugs, it was late 60s, 12 to 12.5% were using drugs.
That's right.
They went on the war on drugs. In the 70s, the end of the 70s, the drug lord came out and said, well, we've kept drug use down to 12 to 12.5%. 80s, they said 12 to 12.5%. 90s, 12 to 12.5%. They haven't done squat except for made the potential for corrupting government officials, gangs killing people. I go back, and I'm still suffering this paradigm shift, but watching the History Channel and what Al Capone did, oh, my gosh, I'm like, let each state decide.
It
comes down to that.
And, you know, we've got enough laws on our books that to make it detrimental to you. Not only is it detrimental to your normal health, but detrimental to you, and you know, punish people who are abusive of any kind of drug use to begin with. I mean, you know, we've got all sorts of penalties for alcohol and or other drug use if you're driving a car or using it in any kind of a dangerous situation. We don't need any more laws. We need to let this thing just work itself out. Legalize it, get it off the books as far as any kind of problems of the punishing people for the use of it's your body. If you want to abuse it, God bless you. I mean, you know, there's nothing I can do about that.
I know. Well, here's another point. You know, it really goes back to the family. How many laws can government pass to prevent teenage pregnancy? I mean, come on. you just can't. But John Adams said this: there is no law that will bridle the passions of the human heart. And if we get federal government reduced, we will, you know, what is it, 48% the average family pays? That means mom pays for the taxes and dad pays the bills. They're both working. It isn't working. So if federal government is reduced substantially, guess what? Mom can stay at home, and then what happens? Oh, there's love and there's care, and kids are wanted that they're not going to want the drugs.
That's absolutely right.
It's a family problem.
Absolutely right. You know, I mean, the drug war is the biggest social problem we've got today, and all the rest of it falls to my way of thinking, really falls in place once we eliminate prohibition, and we'll have a completely different society overnight. And, of course, not the least of which is, I think it was Judge Gray that was talking about the huge number of Mexicans that have died in the war on drugs. But the war on drugs is just an anathema. I mean, it just is a complete and total failure, and it just causes violent crime that's just absolutely just – there's no other excuse. It just will stop. It stops the day we stop prohibition. And
I want to throw out a couple thoughts about –
sorry about that, bud. Real quick, but I did want to hear some thoughts from Mr. Dugan King on it, because I'd like to bring him back in, and then we'll move back to you, okay? Yes,
is,
Mr. King?
Is he on here?
He was. I still see him on the line. Perhaps he had to mute himself. But, Dugan, if at any point you'd like to chime back in, you may have had to have stepped away for a moment. To jump back in, just feel free and go ahead. And
I'm sorry, I had my mute button on. I had to get it out of my pocket and hit the mute button.
I'd like to chime in on that.
My thought on the drug war, if the government really wanted to bring an end or reduce the use of drugs, then they should legalize it and regulate it and create a bureaucracy and tax it and get the black market out. And then they could, and that would be a war on drugs if they did it that way, because that's how they screw up everything else, or that's how they destroy everything else.
Well, yeah, you know, Judge Gray started this campaign called "Regulate Marijuana Like Wine," and there would be a lot of tax money for the state. I'm not a marijuana user.
Yeah, What percentage do we hit cigarettes with a tax? You know, let's let everybody start smoking marijuana. You can tax it. Probably, I don't know, could it balance the budget maybe?
Well, I think as a libertarian, of course, we're more or less, not more or less, we're against taxes to begin with, because confiscating money from one person to give it to another doesn't make any sense to me. And the fact of the matter is that what happens is if we tax things too much, we get the situation like we've got with cigarettes. You know, people buying truckloads of cigarettes in a non-tax state and taking them into New York where they got a $2 pack tax on them is just another way of transferring wealth and creating crime where there should not be one. And so, you know, I'm aware, and I don't completely discount the idea of taxation of various what you might want to call sin taxes. But the fact of the matter is that there's certainly a limit to that, and it's certainly a very definite you have to not do too much of it because you just drive it back underground like it is now. I think that what we have to really consider here is saying to an individual, I'll tell you what I say as a libertarian. I say, if you want to go jump off the Brooklyn Bridge, I'm going to give you a map and tell you to do it on at nighttime on an outgoing tide so we don't have to mess with your body. I mean, if you want to act in a self-destructive manner, there's not one damn thing I can do about it. Now, you know, and I think that most usually the drugs that we take into our bodies are just that. It's a self-destructive act. And, you know,
here's a point that Harry Brown made in his book. I'm just going down with his book, Liberty A to Z. He goes, people should be prosecuted not for what they own, but for what they do, i.e. guns. And he said, basically, if I become president, I'm going to remove all security from the Capitol building until the congressmen repeal all the anti-gun laws and revitalize the Second Amendment.
There you go.
I mean, how many congressmen would start packing heat as soon as security was gone? And we should think about this. It's like, you're robbing our guns from us, and we should be prosecuted for what we do, not for what we own. And, you know, Judge Gray, obviously he's prosecuted criminals. Obviously he'd be hard as nails on people who break the law. We should be prosecuted on what we do and not what we own. If somebody is on drugs and they have an accident, you better believe it. There should be a swift penalty.
Absolutely. But the fact is, if somebody wants to abuse their own bodies, it ought to be up to them to either do it or not. I mean, I think that most of us have things that we could know that we could do better for ourselves, and we fail to do them, and I'm not sure why. That's one of my great mysteries of life. I know that, for example, I need to change certain things that I do in my life as far as diet and exercise are concerned, and I don't know. I don't do it. You tell me why. I think that, and I know that I even feel better. That's the weird thing.
Tell us
everyone gets in the habit, of telling us what we can put in our bodies. Eventually that's going to lead to they're going to prescribe our daily diet for us.
You bet.
That's Obamacare right there. You know, once you have control of the healthcare system, you can be able to control pretty much every aspect of the people's lives.
I always look at the optimistic side of things. When somebody puts a barrier up for an American, we find a way around it. Okay, I mean, one of my favorite things is an essay by Thoreau that's called Civil Disobedience. And in that essay, he talks about us giving Congress the benefit of the doubt for the mischief that they put upon the community. And if we didn't give them the benefit of the doubt, we should have to punish them as we do people that derail trains. And then he goes on and says that if business were not made of the stuff of Indian rubber to bounce around the obstacles placed before it by the Congress, the whole thing would just come to a halt. And so, this has been with us now for 200 years, or 150 years, 1860s. We've had this barrier to our success placed before us by Congress, and we've had to jump around it forever, and we still have to.
Right.
I mean, it hadn't changed a damn bit, guys. We're still out there. We still have to get around the regulation, and we still have to tolerate it or not, as the case may be. My personal feeling is I want to build businesses outside of the United States. I don't want to have to mess with these damned idiot congressmen. I mean, they're just too much of a pain. Do you know that 85% of the hedge funds of the world are in Cayman? Can you imagine that? Damn little island is not big enough to hardly you can walk all the way around it. And, that's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we have lost our capacity to finance new companies in the public market because places like Singapore and Hong Kong are so much less burdened by regulation that nobody wants to mess with Wall Street anymore. I mean,
what do you think about that Dugan and Kelly.
Well, I'd like to comment on what we're talking about, civil disobedience, that strategy. Gandhi used it and sent Britain out of India without a military. He ran the British out of India spiritually by telling the people, look, no government, people in power, their power is only good so long as you cooperate with it. When you quit cooperating with it, their power, they become powerless. And
absolutely,
so if we, if our strategy, rather than shooting back, on the Second Amendment thing, it says a well-regulated militia. We don't have the constitutional militias anymore that we had in the beginning. We have these standing armies that have infiltrated every country in the world just about. We're now the Roman Empire. We're no longer the beacon of light. We're no longer the hope of humanity. We're the Roman Empire, and we are meddling in the affairs of every nation on earth. We've meddled in the affairs of every state, and now they're meddling in the affairs of every individual. Our the rights that protect our privacy are ignored. And so these things that, so there's what we call here in Arkansas, we've got a new plan. It's called our Arkansas caucus leaders. We're formulating right now for free and equal what we call the bypass strategy. You don't go and ask Congress to bite the hand that feeds it by ending the Fed. They're not going to do it. Ron Paul's the only guy in Congress that's going to say, let's end the Fed, maybe Dennis Kucinich, and that's it. They're not. The rest of those guys, they're not going to bite the hand that feeds them. So what you have to do is it's a Gandhi strategy. It's a Henry David Thoreau strategy, civil disobedience. We simply create alternative currencies, and we create a new bridge, local medium exchanges that are popping up as we speak, and we just tell the Federal Reserve, look, you guys can continue to burn up that dollar, and in the meantime, we're creating a fail-safe. We're creating a backup plan, and we're not asking Congress to do it. We're doing it. We're creating currencies like the Berkshire, where you create a merchants association. And this is an ingenious plan, having a merchants association create their own medium of exchange that they agree to accept. And by their agreement to accept it with their goods and services, that's what redeems it. You don't need gold and silver to redeem a currency. You need goods and services filling up a marketplace to redeem a currency.
Yeah. You're absolutely right about that.
So alternative currencies like the Pennsylvania script. And so we build new bridges besides this old crumbling toll bridge called the Federal Reserve. And we let it crumble. We don't end the Fed. We bypass the Fed, so to speak. So that's one of our bypass strategies.
Hold on, gentlemen. I do have someone on the line who been telling I was going to let them in. And this is the National Vice Chairman of the Constitution Party, and that is Randy Stufflebean. Welcome to the show, Randy. How are you?
Well, thank you, Robert. And yes, in addition to being the National Vice Chairman of the Constitution Party, I'm also on the Board of Directors of Free and Equal.
Yes, you are. So, there you
awesome.
Go. Yes, you are.
I just spent a weekend with Christina Tobin and Marcy Forgray. We went up to my little Ozark Mountain retreat, and we just spent 3 days up there strategizing this June 22nd event coming up in Little Rock, which I'm excited to have in my hometown. And what we're doing here, we're going to introduce all kinds of bypass strategies, like getting our sheriffs, our elected sheriffs, and our elected constables in all 75 counties in Arkansas to organize local citizens' militias. And treat, what good is it to have all these guns and bullets if we're not organized? If the UN comes in with their and FEMA comes in and they got they're organized, it's just going to be a slaughter because we don't have a well-regulated militia to go along with the right to bear arms.
Right.
Let me ask you
a
question. Let's go ahead, Randy, and then we'll bring it back to Mr. I believe that was Sheldon, correct?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Randy, and then we'll get Mr. Sheldon.
Okay, thanks. Just a couple of things. One, it has been mentioned about, we do not have a constitutionally standing military / militia. And if you read Article 1, Section 8, the Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And the Article 1, Section 8 talks about the authority that our federal government has over the militia, which really is just another word for military. And I heard say, well, you know, we're not looking for every state to have their own military. Well, actually, that was the way the system was created to begin with, was that the states were responsible for the military. Every state was. And in fact, if you read Article 1, Section 8, you see about the clause around 16 that says that Congress has the responsibility for disciplining, regulating, and so on and so forth. But there's one little piece in there that it says, and for those that are employed by the federal government, by our government, it says, reserving respectively to the states the appointment of officers. Our founding fathers were absolutely petrified of a federally centralized standing army, and so they made it such a way as that, well, while Congress has the responsibility of arming, disciplining, regulating, so on and so forth, the militia, so that they'll be well prepared in case we need to defend these United States of America, not the oil fields of Saudi Arabia or anything else, but defending the shores of these United States of America, they created a system by which they could call forth the militia to create the army that would defend our shores. And so, you know, we just really need to have a clear and understanding of what a true constitutional military would look like. And nobody has, for the most part, a real clear understanding of what that is. And so, you know, we're trying to create all these other go-arounds rather than really forcing a system of getting back to the way it was supposed to be. But a part of that also goes to the fact that in 1913, the year that tyranny got its foothold in America, three primary things happened. Number one, the 16th Amendment was, quote-unquote, ratified. And then following that, 2 months later, the 17th. And the 17th, people just really don't have a real understanding of how much sovereignty the states lost when the 17th Amendment was passed, when senators no longer represented the states in the federal government. That was a major, 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 and in case you missed it the first couple of times, a major check and balance against a burgeoning federal government. If we still had those senators representing our states, there ain't a fat freaking chance the 16th Amendment would have been left to stand, because they'd have said, no, federal government, you're not getting the money that's supposed to be coming to our states. No, federal government, you're not going to have a standing army because it's unconstitutional. We want our military back into our states the way the Constitution mandates it to be in the beginning. So there's a few things that we have just totally lost, and we need to have a real clear understanding of what was lost in 1913. And then, of course, you've all been mentioning the Federal Reserve, which also got its foothold in December the 12th, 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act was passed. There was a lot of evil that was perpetrated in that year, and we need to have a clear understanding of what it's going to take to get us back. And it is not simply to go around. I understand we need some go around if we can't get the federal government to start following the Constitution. Follow the Constitution and uphold it, and I appreciate the opportunity to have the moment to speak. Thanks a lot, Robert.
Oh, you're welcome, and there will be some more time to speak for everyone, but I do want to point out for those listening to the live portion here of Bard's Logic Political Talk, that will only last another 12 and a half minutes. For those who want to listen to the extended version, which will be coming in, as I said, about 12 and a half minutes, call in at 347-945-7428 just to listen in, or if you'd like to chime in as well. If not, please just come back to the show immediately after it's ending and listen to the rest of the show through the archives. And so for those of you who have been listening to the live portion here of the show, thank you very much for coming. Take care and have a good night. I'd like to say that now, because we'll probably the moving on to the end of the live portion, and I'm going to get the opportunity to thank the audience for coming in or listening in this evening. So I'll bring it back to you, Randy, and just let the folks know we'll be getting into the extended version soon. So go ahead.
Well, thank you, Robert. Hey, I just really appreciate, you know, what the judge had brought to the table. I appreciate some of the other perspectives. And certainly we must begin start to think outside the box if we are ever going to start taking back our country. And certainly, you know, there's a lot of good initiatives that are being taken, you know, locally. And I will say, and I would like to possibly make one suggestion, kind of in a correction kind of thing, rather than the sheriffs, you know, creating a quote unquote militia, I think it's very, very constitutional that the sheriffs can create the posses, the posse comitatus kind of thing. So I think just the terminology, and I don't know if, you know, people are going to freak out one way or the other, but I think it is more constitutional that the sheriffs can definitely, you know, deputize, and they've got their posse. And I think it's a great idea in that particular regard.
And two things real quick you mentioned earlier, you know, in conversation we had, is you had a discussion with some folks about two of our main topics tonight, and that was about the IRS and Benghazi. So we touch on that a little bit, and then move, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit, and then move back
I
want to get that in.
Robert, I mean, you know, being a retired Marine, I am so freaking pissed off at our elected officials, our government, whatever you want to call it, you know, the facade of a government that would leave our people defenseless. You know, one of the things four-star Admiral, retired Admiral Lyons had said, that there were jets that could have been there within 90 minutes, within 90 minutes, to provide support and to take out those mortar positions that actually, you know, was a major cause of a lot of the problems that were faced in the death, and allowed them to really overtake the compound and stuff. 90 minutes. And they were, and our government is trying to say, well, we couldn't have got people there within, you know, nine hours, and the skirmish was already over. Bull crap. You know, the Marine Force recon was there within a couple of hours and could have been there to provide support. There was other, you know, there was other alternatives that could have been brought in, but yet they were left there to die. Our federal government left our men and our women there to die. And if somebody's head doesn't roll on that, we are sadly missing what should be justice to those people who knew what was going on and left those people to die. And of course, you know, then you've got the IRS on top of all this that has, you know, trying to intimidate people, not let people have their, you know, tax deductible status. But, you know, the fact that they use this as a, you know, our founding father said it, the tax is a force, an evil force, the taxing power is, and they use it as a weapon against us. And we have got to destroy this IRS and take our country back.
Hey, good man. For you. You have to take your head down with it.
Go ahead, Donald.
I think that's very well said, and I think that, you know, a couple of things come to my mind. You know, I'm old enough, so I was brought up with a military obligation. I spent 6 years in the Arkansas Air National Guard. I thought the National Guard was what we were talking about with a militia. And I still think it is. And I think that we've got to, you know, each governor of each state has got a National Guard. And, you know, I think that this is really, you know, it's a force to be reckoned with, and it should be what we can just look toward when we're talking about reconstituting and taking back to the people the power that is ours by the very nature of our Constitution. And by the way, one of the reasons I get so excited about this war on drugs is because I did have the pleasure of spending some time for contempt of court in a federal lockup in New York City and saw how these young black men basically are being treated. There is no such thing as a Bill of Rights if you are a young black male brought in on a drug charge. I mean, the Bill of Rights just doesn't even exist. It's not even on your radar scope. And by the way, I should have asked Judge Gray this because he was a former prosecutor. I wanted to find out if it's really true that young prosecutors have to have a 95% conviction rate in order to be promotable in the United States Justice Department. That's, that passes right on past Hitler, and we're right up around Stalin's conviction rate. There's no such thing as a jury trial in this country anymore. We got a young man down here named Howard Finkelstein, who is our elected head of our public defender's office. I had him as one of my speakers at one of my meetings down here for libertarians, and I asked him what percentage of the crimes that are brought before you, I should say, brought into his court, the court down here, go to a jury trial. He said less than 0.75% get jury trials. I mean, everything is plea bargained out, gentlemen. I mean, that's ridiculous. You have to plead guilty to something in order to be able to get out of the system. It's ridiculous on its face. Our jury trials are non-existent. Our proper representation by counsel, you can forget that. At the federal level, there is no such thing as a Speedy Trial Act. It just doesn't exist. I mean, we have lost our rights as far as the Bill of Rights are concerned. If you are accused of a drug charge in this country at this time, you are going to plead guilty to something, or you're going to sit in jail until you do. It's ridiculous. Yeah,
Well, our Fourth and our Fifth Amendments, which are supposed to guarantee us against unreasonable search and seizure, and to guarantee that we do not lose life, liberty, or property without the due process of the law, has been thrown out with the Patriot Act and with the NDAA and, all these other unconstitutional pieces of garbage legislation. What's real interesting, though, I will tell you this. I also did covered a little bit of a story about the AP, the Associated Press, who's a little bit ticked off right now because they found out that the federal government invaded their privacy without any warrants of arrest, warrants to do so or anything like that. And, I'm like, I kind of feel good about that. Finally, they're getting a piece of dose of their own medicine, finally. And maybe they just might start reporting a little bit better instead of covering for these jerks up there.
You're right. The thing that shocked me was how horrible, as I said to you, I was just a right-wing Republican until I got in there and saw what was going on as far as these drug laws are concerned. And that's one of the reasons I am so in favor of not only ending prohibition, which will happen. I'm convinced when you see people like Clinton coming in talking about ending prohibition, he's going to get on the right side of this wave. And it will be an idea that's time has come. I think that, we're going to see an end to that. But we're going to also have to go in there and expunge the records. These kids don't deserve to be branded felons all their lives, lose their right to vote, lose all their, a felon in this country is just almost a slave. As a matter of fact, Judge Gray was saying he's a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Those guys just frankly say that if you're accused of a drug crime in this country, you are basically put back into slavery. It's the reestablishment of slavery in the United States, and it's just absolutely horrible. I mean, it's just we really need to get prohibition ended once and for all, and it just has to be. It will be. By the way, I'm absolutely sure that this is an idea that's time has come.
Kelly and Dugan. Well, we'll go with Kelly, and then we'll go over to you, Dugan. Go ahead. I think maybe Kelly put his mic on mute. Are both of them dead?
he may be putting his son to bed.
Okay, I'm sorry. I agree with everything you said, and I'm glad there's another Archie on the line.
Oh, there you go.
And so that's a rare occasion, and we're being broadcast. We're on the East Coast. Is that correct?
Well, I'm in Florida.
In Florida,
This Archie is in Florida right now.
All right, okay. Say hi to Huckabee while you're down there.
I will.
But, yeah, I agree with everything. The war on drugs, I believe people are waking up. There's a lot more waking up to do. That's what Free and Equal is trying to accomplish. It's just about it's freedom. You can't coerce people about what they put in their bodies. I would like to see it legalized. And if there's any tax, that tax would go to rehabbing people that have lack
there
of
you go.
Control and need help, you know. And
that makes sense.
Yeah, do it that way, and maybe by taxing it, that'll get the black market and the advertising out of the way, and it'll reduce the number of people that are lives are ruined because of drugs. So if we put a moral force behind it, I think we can solve it. But I believe the problem is because of the Federal Reserve, they've tilted the playing field that we live on, and there's this elite. And they tilted that field, and we all have to play on it, and it's tilted in their favor. And so we have all these kind of issues because we live in a desperation. These people have a monopoly over the American public credit. You know, why is a public credit? That should belong to the American people. It shouldn't belong to private bankers. And as long as these bankers have this power to create money out of thin air, and the way they can jack the lending lever and create booms and busts in our economy and tell us, oh, it's just a business cycle. We don't know where it comes from. It's kind of like the weather. And they're sitting there doing it, you know, by just moving, by creating loans or not creating loans. That's their power. That's how you create booms and busts. So if we start striking at the root, all these thousands of bushes that we're hacking at, all they do, they go, as long as the money power is in power, you know, we can hack on the bushes, but they're just going to go back a different way. We got to get to the root. You know, we got to eliminate this power, and we got to get people to recognize that, you know, the Democrats aren't the problem. The Republicans aren't the problem. The problem is Wall Street, because Wall Street controls both these parties, and everybody, every single position in government is a two-party puppet show.
Obama is
ignorant as hell. Look at all his Wall Street advisors that surround him.
Let me say to you that this Archie's going to disagree with you just a little bit. I spent 22 years on Wall Street, and I tell you right now, Wall Street's so damn simple it's just almost scary. All the Wall Street does is bring buyers and sellers of money together. Now, what you got to understand is that money is nothing. Money is an imagination. Money is just a means of exchange. And it just expedites, it takes away the need for barter, i.e. it makes it easier for us to settle up accounts when we have things that are in the private economy. If you read somebody like Friedrich Hayek, who, by the way, was a libertarian by virtue of what he established as far as the economics of Austrian economics. Get into that a little bit, Archie, because you're going to learn that demonizing bankers, demonizing government, demonizing things does not work. You know, there are no demons. The fact of the matter is that when Shakespeare came up with the idea that there is no good nor ill, but thinking makes it so, he put words on us that we ought to really realize have a great deal of truth to them. You know, you can talk about Wall Street. Well, Wall Street is just a place where buyers and sellers of money come together. And by the way, Wall Street has lost almost all of its power. The money game has moved out of the United States. London took us over because London deregulated when we re-regulated, and they took over of a lot of the finances of the world, Wall Street is no longer the money center that it once was. Now, that's good on one side and bad on another. And I want to tell you right now, what you want to keep in your head is that right now we're still the reserve currency of the world with the USD. The United States dollar, we want it to remain the reserve currency of the world. Now, why is that? Because it allows you as a U.S. citizen to become more highly paid and for less effort than any other single thing that you could have happen for you. And now, you know, what is a dollar worth? What I say to people, if you could use U.S. dollars to buy an acre of land in Arkansas, then dollars have value. That's the only value they got. If you can't buy an acre of land in Arkansas for dollars, then the dollars are non-existent. They just go away. We want U.S. dollars to be U.S. dollars. And the reason we do is because we want to be of value to the rest of the world. We want everyone to accept our dollars for whatever the hell we want to buy. And that's really where it's at. And you know, I don't understand why. Well, number one, when I got to Wall Street, a banker sat me down and explained to me what the Federal Reserve was. Well, sure, it's a private bank. There's nothing wrong with private banks. Banks are just places where people put their money. And if you want to see the poorest countries in the world, look at where they don't have good currency. You know, one of my favorite economists points out that, you know, if you take a look at the place with the highest standard of living, believe it or not, it's a country that has no natural resources. And what it has is an honest banking system. The Swiss have the highest standard of living of any country in the world. And then you take a look at a place like Indonesia that has every single possible wealth creation that you can imagine, but it has no standard of living because their wealth is hung around their women's neck is gold. Now, there's no circulation to gold. Dollars circulate. Gold does not. If you don't have a currency that circulates, the people starve. We all starve. You got to have circulation. It's like blood. If you shut the blood supply off, you die. And if you shut off the banking system, we all starve to death. You got to have circulation. You got to have a currency that everybody accepts and everybody's willing to buy or sell an acre of land for X number of dollars.
If I may, I don't disagree with that very much. The only disagreement that I have is the fact that the Federal Reserve is printing all this money out of thin air and making every dollar less valuable. And so now we've got China, Russia, Brazil, India, and South Africa that are looking to get out of using the U.S. dollar because of its worthlessness. So while you're absolutely right, you know, that they're you have to have a value, and once that value is no longer there, people are not going to use it. And that's what we've got is we've got the Federal Reserve that is creating a valueless dollar, and it's getting more or less value every day. And so we've got countries around the world trying to get out of using the U.S. dollar. And unless we stop this insane printing and start doing some things different, we're screwed on that one.
I agree with you entirely, but you know, remember one thing. The Federal Reserve, regardless of the fact that it is indeed a private institution, still is a creature of Congress. We know our deficit spending is a disgrace. It's an absolute travesty. But the Federal Reserve has to print money when Congress tells it to. You know, we're borrowing money like a bunch of drunk Indians, and you're absolutely right. It's disgrace, and it's degrading the quality of our currency. And what I have said to people before, I think we have a Marine on the line here. The fact of the matter is the only thing that gives the dollar any value at all is the United States Marine Corps. I mean, if we didn't have the strongest, if we didn't have the strongest military on the face of the planet, the dollar wouldn't be – you could just go burn them. okay? Mm-hmm. But right now we're still still where it's at. We are absolutely the power to be reckoned with. And and as far as, let's say, the Chinese are concerned, the Chinese have got to have us. They are absolutely dependent on us buying their trash. I mean, if we didn't buy it,
why should Congress borrow its own money from private bankers who created out of thin air, and why should Congress pay principal and interest for their own money?
Because it's the biggest Ponzi. Let me tell you something. What you don't want to do is pull back the curtain, okay? You don't want to know how big the Ponzi scheme is.
I've been studying it for over 30 years. Yes, I know.
Well, let me tell you, it makes Madoff look like Nat in the third grade. I mean, he ain't even close. I mean, you don't want to know all the crap that's going down as far as the money supply is concerned and how it's being manipulated.
Oh, yeah.
Because
schemes come to an end, and the Federal Reserve notes will probably very soon be coming to an end. And I think the problem that the Federal Reserve notes being the world currency reserve, it got there as a result of the Bretton Woods Conference back in the 1940s when after they inflated the paper currencies all over the world to fund World War II, they realized, hey, we can't mine gold fast enough to keep up with all this paper currency that we've created. We're going to have to get off this gold standard because we just can't live up to that anymore because we've grown. We've inflated the paper money, and in order to make the gold match the paper like it should, we're going to have to skyrocket the price of gold. But let's just do this. Let's get off the gold standard, and let's make the U.S. dollar, since America is the most powerful country in the world. Their workforce is real powerful. They can back it up with public credit. Let's make the American dollar the world currency reserve. And everybody jumped on that bandwagon. But here's the consequences of that Ponzi scheme. When China decides, hey, these dollars are worthless, let's get rid of them, which is what they're doing now. They're buying up assets. They're buying up all the physical gold and silver. That's why you can't get delivery of physical gold and silver. Between China and the central banks of Europe, they're all sneaking in, buying up the physical gold and silver. In the meantime, why is gold and silver crashing? Because they're dumping the paper gold. It's the old Rothschild goldsmith trick. They're engineering this panic in gold using fake paper gold. In the meantime, as soon as the physical gold hits the market, they're scarfing it up. You can't get delivery on physical gold and silver.
Here's the problem you got with physical gold, okay? Number one, it doesn't earn you anything at all. I mean, it's strictly a speculation, okay? There is no such thing as a return on gold. It has no dividend that it pays. And
let me stop you there. Let me give you a counterexample.
Okay.
I look back at the price of silver when I was 18 years old in 1972. If I would have bought $5,000 worth of silver, back on the day that I did this calculation, I think silver was priced at about $35 an ounce. And it would have been that investment of $5,000 for my retirement would have been worth $205,000 on that day when I did the calculation. And so what it is, inflation causes commodities to rise in value. So as long as all governments inflate their currency, and so by putting your money in gold and silver, the value is going to increase with that inflation rate. So instead of getting interest on your money, which probably your money depreciates sometimes faster than the interest, right now, as the case now, you can, if you put your money in the bank and get 1% and the inflation eats up 5%, you're not saving for retirement there. But the gold and silver have skyrocketed, and so, I'm not going to take up a whole lot of time. I'm sorry, but I'd like to get into it with you.
I understand what you're saying exactly. The fact of the matter is, now, I will say to you that silver has a commodity value. Gold has no commodity value, okay? Silver is being used constantly in everything that we do today, and it's well-placed confidence in saying that silver, we ought to be mining more of it, and we will mine more of it because we're going to use a lot more of it. But the fact is that we're not using any gold. I mean, you want to hang gold around your wellman's neck, fine, that's good. No big deal. But the fact is it does not circulate. It does not build companies, and it does not cause employment. It just causes, you know, your woman to get a heavy neck. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
One thing, though, in the issue of gold, you're using some words, I think, not exactly in a real correct manner, because you mentioned that silver is going up in value or gold goes up in value. Well, actually, the silver and gold is not actually going up in value. They still buy basically the same amount, have the same buying power now that they did back then. It's just that, you know, it looks like, you know, if you bought silver at $35 an ounce, you know, now it's $100. I don't know what it is, but I'm just using this as an example.
Right.
Silver's not buying anymore. It's just that the inflation rate makes it kind of almost sound like it's worth more, but it's still just worth what it has always been worth, and it still has the same amount of buying power. It just takes more of those fake dollars to substantiate what its real value is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I agree with it. It's not so much that silver is going up in value, it's that what you're buying silver with is devaluing.
Well,
right.
That's not quite. In silver's case, that's not quite true, because what's happening in here is we're using a lot more of it in a lot more products. Now, we're not using a lot more gold in a lot more products, but we are in silver. We are going to be digging more silver out of the ground, and we're going to use our best engineers and our, you know, best technology to do that, because we're actually using silver for various things, and those things are things like computers and any kind of electrical type of situation. So, but regardless of that, let's stay on the idea that we need money has to circulate to have value, what money really does is allows you to direct human effort. Okay, let's think of what money does. Money allows you to hire engineers. Money allows you to hire bricklayers. Money allows you to buy farmland. Money allows you to do things that are otherwise, you know, you're not capable of doing. But the real thing is human effort is directable by the use of money. And so what we're really talking about here is what will you as an individual give up your life moment for, and that is a commodity of some type that is exchangeable for other people's human effort. In other words, you're wanting something that somebody else can give you, like an automobile or an airplane or a house, and these are things that human beings produce. And so productivity is the key. And one of the things that has come to my attention is the fact that they keep talking about human productivity going up. And I watched something called How They Make It. You know, it's a science channel program of how we produce things. My Lord, do you understand that it takes like only 48 hours or something to produce a Peterbilt truck? My God, I mean, look at that thing. It can, you know, it can haul, I don't know, what, 20,000 pounds across the country at 60 miles an hour, and it takes only 48 man hours to build that sucker? I mean, good Lord. Now, you're talking about productivity. There's a situation that, you know, you can see it, you can feel it, you can touch it, and it can just do things for you that otherwise couldn't be done. You know, so every time we took
a
human effort,
money directs activity, and
exactly.
And Franklin figured that out, and when he introduced the Pennsylvania script system back in the 1720s, there wasn't any gold and silver to be able to set up a central bank style banking system like London had, and the border. You know, Franklin noticed when he first came to Philadelphia as a young man, there was this paper money called scrip that was circulating that was issued to pay for military services to people.
Mm-hmm.
It was just basically an IOU on the colony, and they could pay.
Right.
They could use that to pay their taxes. And when all the taxes were paid and the script was gone out of circulation, Franklin noticed that, hey, suddenly we're back to barter, and now the velocity of trade has slowed down, and now we're not producing as much, and now we're in a recession, and now people are moving off, and we have all these buildings that are for rent, and the economy is just about dead in the water. I propose, and he writes this beautiful treatise where he proposes that, let's bring the script money back into circulation, and let's keep it permanently circulating. And he drafted this saying that the colony, Franklin was only in his 20s at the time, and Pennsylvania thought it was brilliant, and so they went ahead and created the Pennsylvania script, and they awarded it to Franklin, and it was the best money system ever devised in the history of man. It made the other colonies follow Pennsylvania's lead, and they started doing scripts, and it all really depended on how it was managed. And so here's a money system that didn't have gold or silver, didn't need that. It had all the commodities in the marketplace is what backed Pennsylvania script. And so here's
what,
when you say money directs activity, here's how Franklin used it. They created money to put people to work, and this generates this kind of a cycle that completes the economic cycle. Create the money to put people to work. When people work, they create wealth that fills up the marketplace with goods and services. And why are these valuable goods and services? Because this is what we need to survive. We can't eat gold and silver.
No, we cannot.
Any goods and services that we demand, someone's going to figure out how to supply it in a free marketplace, and so that we can survive. So Franklin created this perfect free marketplace, and he didn't have to put the colony in debt by borrowing gold from the Bank of England. He didn't have to throw us under the rule of a banking monopoly just because they had control of the gold. He decided, you know, if we'll make loans to colonists that will put their land up as collateral. So this Pennsylvania script is really backed by land. And Franklin said, by putting it into land, you know, gold leaves our colony as fast as we can get our hands on gold. It leaves and goes to Britain because of the mercantile system.
Hold on, I know this, that's a pet topic of yours. We'll definitely get back to it, but I did get a message here from Randy saying that he's got to go, so I wanted to say thank you, Randy, for coming on to the show. Really appreciate your input, and look forward to talking again. And one thing I do want to talk about before the end of the recorded session here on the show, the extended period, is something that I know we're talking about some things we disagreed on, but one thing I think we all can agree upon is about the Free and Equal .org, the United We Stand Festival, and I'd like to talk some about that as well when we conclude, when Diggin, you conclude, talk about the script. But I did want to say thank you, Randy, about that, about coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Robert. And I still haven't given up hope. I'm just not sure I'm going to be able to make it down. It seems like a real exciting time, and I'd sure like to get to meet some other folks that have become associated with the Free and Equal now, and, you know, of course, see Christina. But, you know, I know that you're going to be headed down there, Robert, and my heart is sure, you know, down there because, you know, even though I'm the national vice chairman of the Constitution Party, I absolutely am for the leveling of the playing field, you know, for all parties. We must make these United States a multi-party system and destroy this two-party duopoly if we're ever going to see the level of corruption and all of that diminished and get our country back to its constitutionally mandated roots. I absolutely believe that with every fiber of my being, and so that's what I'm here to do, is destroy that two-party duopoly and, you know, get a fair competition of, you know, of political ideas and all of that into that particular arena. So God bless everyone. It's been great talking with you. Thanks a lot.
Before you leave, can I just,
Randy, take care.
Before that Constitutional Party man leaves, let me mention something to you guys. Florida has gotten open ballot access passed by the Libertarian Party some years ago. One of the men that is involved with that, an attorney, is going to be putting out a video very shortly talking about how that was done. we have some of the easiest ballot access for third parties in the world and in Florida now. And so just be aware of that, gentlemen. We're going to put that out for you, and it'll be on YouTube.
Outstanding.
And by the way, I'm really interested in getting to Arkansas. I haven't been in Arkansas in years. I'm looking forward to getting down there. Maybe I'll get down there during your period when you guys are going to have that situation in June.
It's a month to the day when the show started tonight, June 22nd.
Thank you. June 22nd, I'm going to sure try to be in Little Rock.
Sounds good.
Excellent. I look forward to it. Be sure to look up Dugan King. I will be there.
Dugan King, I will be looking you up. I'm Donald Sheldon, and I'm from Malvern, and I'll be looking you up.
I look forward to meeting you, sir.
Well,
thank
good
you,
night,
sir.
Everyone, and thanks a lot. It's been great talking with you, and I look forward to eventually meeting you all. So God bless and good night.
Robert,
good night,
thank
good night, Randy.
You.
Take care. All right, Dugan, thank you very much. Let's see. A couple others have left. I see the other ones might have dropped as well. Kelly, are you still there? Okay, I didn't know that the other folks were not going to be able to stay on, so thank you very much to the audience for staying and listening to the extended version of Bard's Logic Political Talk, the Grassroots We the People show. So please share this show by going and sharing the link with folks so they can listen to it, and they can share the link as well, or they can also download it and put it on their iPhone or their even a CD where they can listen to it in their cars or radios. Well, not radios, but in their cars or their iPhones or iPads, things of that nature. So I will end tonight, and of course, thank you all for listening to the archives as well. And I will end tonight as I do every night, and that is a song by Aubrey Ashburn. And you can hear more of her song, her music and songs, by going to www.aubreyashburn.com. So thank you once again, everyone, for coming to the show. Take care and have a good night.